shares in it, insofar as it listens to and obeys it. This is the sense in which we speak of taking account of one's father or one's friends, not that in which we speak of accounting for a mathematical property, that the irrational element is in some sense persuaded by a rational principle, is indicated also by the giving of advice and by all reproof and exhortation. And if this element also must be said to have a rational principle, that which has a rational principle, as well as that which has not, will be twofold, one subdivision having it in the strict sense and in itself, and the other having a tendency to obey, as one does one's father. Virtue, too, is distinguished into kinds, in accordance with this difference. For we say that some of the virtues are intellectual and others moral. Philosophic wisdom and understanding and practical wisdom being intellectual, liberality and temperance, moral. For in speaking about a man's character, we do not say that he is wise or has understanding, but that he is good-tempered or temperate. Yet we praise the wise man also with respect to his state of mind, and of states of mind we call those which merit praise virtues. Book 2. 1. Virtue, then, being of two kinds, intellectual and moral, intellectual virtue in the main owes both its birth and its growth to teaching, for which reason it requires experience and time, while moral virtue comes about as a result of habit, whence also its name, ethike, is one that is formed by a slight variation from the word ethos, habit. From this, it is also plain that none of the moral virtues arises in us by nature, for nothing that exists by nature can form a habit contrary to its nature. For instance, the stone which by nature moves downwards cannot be habituated to move upwards, not even if one tries to train it by throwing it up 10,000 times. Nor can fire be habituated to move downwards, nor can anything else that by nature behaves in one way be trained to behave in another. Neither by nature, then, nor contrary to nature, do the virtues arise in us. Rather, we are adapted by nature to receive them, and are made perfect by habit. Again, of all the things that come to us by nature, we first acquire the potentiality and later exhibit the activity. This is plain in the case of the senses, for it was not by often seeing or often hearing that we got these senses, but, on the contrary, we had them before we used them, and did not come to have them by using them. But the virtues we get by first exercising them, as also happens in the case of the arts as well, for the things we have to learn before we can do them, we learn by doing them. E.g., men become builders by building, and lyre players by playing the lyre. So too we become just by doing just acts, temperate by doing temperate acts, brave by doing brave acts. This is confirmed by what happens in states. For legislators make the citizens good by forming habits in them, and this is the wish of every legislator, and those who do not effect it miss their mark, and it is in this that a good constitution differs from a bad one. Again, it is from the same causes and by the same means that every virtue is both produced and destroyed, and similarly every art. For it is from playing the lyre that both good and bad lyre players are produced, and the corresponding statement is true of builders and of all the rest. Men will be good or bad builders as a result of building well or badly. For if this were not so, there would have been no need of a teacher, but all men would have been born good or bad at their craft. This, then, is the case with the virtues also. By doing the acts that we do in our transactions with other men, we become just or unjust, and by doing the acts that we do in the presence of danger, and being habituated to feel fear or confidence, we become brave or cowardly. The same is true of appetites and feelings of anger. Some men become temperate and good-tempered, others self-indulgent and irascible, by behaving in one way or the other in the appropriate circumstances. Thus, in one word, states of character arise out of like activities. This is why the activities we exhibit must be of a certain kind. It is because the states of character correspond to the differences between these. It makes no small difference, then, whether we form habits of one kind or of another from our very youth. It makes a very great difference, or rather, all the difference. 2. Since then the present inquiry does not aim at theoretical knowledge like the others, for we are inquiring not in order to know what virtue is, but in order to become good, since otherwise our inquiry would have been of no use. We must examine the nature of actions, namely, how we ought to do them. For these determine also the nature of the states of character that are produced, as we have said. Now, that we must act according to the right rule is a common principle and must be assumed, it will be discussed later, i.e., both what the right rule is and how it is related to the other virtues. But this must be agreed upon beforehand, that the whole account of matters of conduct must be given in outline and not precisely, as we said at the very beginning, that the accounts we demand must be in accordance with the subject matter, matters concerned with conduct and questions of what is good for us have no fixity, any more than matters of health. The general account being of this nature, the account of particular cases is yet more lacking in exactness, for they do not fall under any art or precept, but the agents themselves must in each case consider what is appropriate to the occasion, as happens also in the art of medicine or of navigation. But though our present account is of this nature, we must give what help we can. First, then, let us consider this, that it is the nature of such things to be destroyed by defect and excess, as we see in the case of strength and of health. For to gain light on things imperceptible, we must use the evidence of sensible things. Both excessive and defective exercise destroys the strength, and similarly drink or food which is above or below a certain amount destroys the health, while that which is proportionate both produces and increases and preserves it. So too is it, then, in the case of temperance and courage and the other virtues. For the man who flies from and fears everything and does not stand his ground against anything becomes a coward. And the man who fears nothing at all but goes to meet every danger becomes rash. And similarly, the man who indulges in every pleasure and abstains from none becomes self-indulgent, while the man who shuns every pleasure, as boors do, becomes in a way insensible. Temperance and courage, then, are destroyed by excess and defect, and preserved by the mean. But not only are the sources and causes of their origination and growth the same as those of their destruction, but also the sphere of their actualization will be the same. For this is also true of the things which are more evident to sense, e.g. of strength. It is produced by taking much food and undergoing much exertion, and it is the strong man that will be most able to do these things. So too is it with the virtues. By abstaining from pleasures we become temperate, and it is when we have become so that we are most able to abstain from them. And similarly too in the case of courage, for by being habituated to despise things that are terrible and to stand our ground against them, we become brave. And it is when we have become so that we shall be most able to stand our ground against them. 3. We must take as a sign of states of character the pleasure or pain that ensues on acts. For the man who abstains from bodily pleasures and delights in this very fact is temperate, while the man who is annoyed at it is self-indulgent, and he who stands his ground against things that are terrible and delights in this, or at least is not pained, is brave, while the man who is pained is a coward. For moral excellence is concerned with pleasures and pains. It is on account of the pleasure that we do bad things, and on account of the pain that we abstain from noble ones. Hence we ought to have been brought up in a particular way from our very youth, as Plato says, so as both to delight in and to be pained by the things that we ought. For this is the right education. Again, if the virtues are concerned with actions and passions, and every passion and every action is accompanied by pleasure and pain, for this reason also virtue will be concerned with pleasures and pains. This is indicated also by the fact that punishment is inflicted by these means, for it is a kind of cure, and it is the nature of cures to be effected by contraries. Again, as we said but lately, every state of soul has a nature relative to and concerned with the kind of things by which it tends to be made worse or better. But it is by reason of pleasures and pains that men become bad, by pursuing and avoiding these, either the pleasures and pains they ought not, or when they ought not, or as they ought not, or by going wrong in one of the other similar ways that may be distinguished. Hence men even define the virtues as certain states of impassivity and rest. Not well, however, because they speak absolutely, and do not say, as one ought, and as one ought not, and when one ought or ought not, and the other things that may be added. We assume, then, that this kind of excellence tends to do what is best with regard to pleasures and pains, and vice does the contrary. The following facts also may show us that virtue and vice are concerned with these same things, there being three objects of choice and three of avoidance: the noble, the advantageous, the pleasant, and their contraries, the base, the injurious, the painful. About all of these the good man tends to go right and the bad man to go wrong, and especially about pleasure, for this is common to the animals, and also it accompanies all objects of choice. For even the noble and the advantageous appear pleasant. Again, it has grown up with us all from our infancy. This is why it is difficult to rub off this passion, ingrained as it is in our life. And we measure even our actions, some of us more and others less, by the rule of pleasure and pain. For this reason, then, our whole inquiry must be about these, for to feel delight and pain, rightly or wrongly, has no small effect on our actions. Again, it is harder to fight with pleasure than with anger, to use Heraclitus' phrase, but both art and virtue are always concerned with what is harder. For even the good is better when it is harder. Therefore, for this reason also, the whole concern both of virtue and of political science is with pleasures and pains. For the man who uses these well will be good. He who uses them badly, bad. That virtue then is concerned with pleasures and pains, and that by the acts from which it arises, it is both increased and, if they are done differently, destroyed, and that the acts from which it arose are those in which it actualizes itself. Let this be taken as said. 4. The question might be asked, what we mean by saying that we must become just by doing just acts and temperate by doing temperate acts. For if men do just and temperate acts, they are already just and temperate, exactly as if they do what is in accordance with the laws of grammar and of music, they are grammarians and musicians. Or is this not true, even of the arts? It is possible to do something that is in accordance with the laws of grammar, either by chance or at the suggestion of another. A man will be a grammarian, then, only when he has done something grammatical and done it grammatically. And this means doing it in accordance with the grammatical knowledge in himself. Again, the case of the arts and that of the virtues are not similar, for the products of the arts have their goodness in themselves, so that it is enough that they should have a certain character. But if the acts that are in accordance with the virtues have themselves a certain character, it does not follow that they are done justly or temperately. The agent also must be in a certain condition when he does them. In the first place, he must have knowledge. Secondly, he must choose the acts, and choose them for their own sakes. And thirdly, his action must proceed from a firm and unchangeable character. These are not reckoned in as conditions of the possession of the arts, except the bare knowledge, but as a condition of the possession of the virtues knowledge has little or no weight, while the other conditions count not for a little, but for everything, i.e., the very conditions which result from often doing just and temperate acts. Actions, then, are called just and temperate when they are such as the just or the temperate man would do. But it is not the man who does these that is just and temperate, but the man who also does them as just and temperate men do them. It is well said, then, that it is by doing just acts that the just man is produced, and by doing temperate acts the temperate man. Without doing these, no one would have even a prospect of becoming good. But most people do not do these, but take refuge in theory, and think they are being philosophers and will become good in this way, behaving somewhat like patients who listen attentively to their doctors but do none of the things they are ordered to do. As the latter will not be made well in body by such a course of treatment, the former will not be made well in soul by such a course of philosophy. 5. Next, we must consider what virtue is. Since things that are found in the soul are of three kinds, passions, faculties, states of character, virtue must be one of these. By passions I mean appetite, anger, fear, confidence, envy, joy, friendly feeling, hatred, longing, emulation, pity, and in general the feelings that are accompanied by pleasure or pain. By faculties, the things in virtue of which we are said to be capable of feeling these, e.g. of becoming angry, or being pained, or feeling pity. By states of character, the things in virtue of which we stand well or badly with reference to the passions, e.g. with reference to anger, we stand badly if we feel it violently or too weakly, and well if we feel it moderately, and similarly with reference to the other passions. Now neither the virtues nor the vices are passions because we are not called good or bad on the ground of our passions, but are so called on the ground of our virtues and our vices, and because we are neither praised nor blamed for our passions. For the man who feels fear or anger is not praised, nor is the man who simply feels anger blamed, but the man who feels it in a certain way. But for our virtues and our vices, we are praised or blamed. Again, we feel anger and fear without choice, but the virtues are modes of choice or involve choice. Further, in respect of the passions we are said to be moved, but in respect of the virtues and the vices, we are said not to be moved, but to be disposed in a particular way. For these reasons also they are not faculties. For we are neither called good nor bad, nor praised nor blamed, for the simple capacity of feeling the passions. Again, we have the faculties by nature, but we are not made good or bad by nature. We have spoken of this before. If, then, the virtues are neither passions nor faculties, all that remains is that they should be states of character. Thus we have stated what virtue is, in respect of its genus. 6. We must, however, not only describe virtue as a state of character, but also say what sort of state it is. We may remark, then, that every virtue or excellence both brings into good condition the thing of which it is the excellence, and makes the work of that thing be done well. E.g., the excellence of the eye makes both the eye and its work good, for it is by the excellence of the eye that we see well. Similarly, the excellence of the horse makes a horse both good in itself and good at running and at carrying its rider and at awaiting the attack of the enemy. Therefore, if this is true in every case, the virtue of man also will be the state of character which makes a man good and which makes him do his own work well. How this is to happen, we have stated already. But it will be made plain also by the following consideration of the specific nature of virtue. In everything that is continuous and divisible, it is possible to take more, less, or an equal amount, and that either in terms of the thing itself or relatively to us, and the equal is an intermediate between excess and defect. By the intermediate in the object, I mean that which is equidistant from each of the extremes, which is one and the same for all men, by the intermediate relatively to us, that which is neither too much nor too little, and this is not one nor the same for all. For instance, if 10 is many and 2 is few, 6 is the intermediate, taken in terms of the object, for it exceeds and is exceeded by an equal amount. This is intermediate according to arithmetical proportion. But the intermediate relatively to us is not to be taken so. If 10 pounds are too much for a particular person to eat and 2 too little, it does not follow that the trainer will order 6 pounds. For this also is perhaps too much for the person who is to take it, or too little. Too little for Milo, too much for the beginner in athletic exercises. The same is true of running and wrestling. Thus a master of any art avoids excess and defect, but seeks the intermediate and chooses this, the intermediate not in the object, but relatively to us. If it is thus, then, that every art does its work well by looking to the intermediate and judging its works by this standard, so that we often say of good works of art that it is not possible either to take away or to add anything, implying that excess and defect destroy the goodness of works of art, while the mean preserves it, and good artists, as we say, look to this in their work. And if, further, virtue is more exact and better than any art, as nature also is, then virtue must have the quality of aiming at the intermediate. I mean moral virtue, for it is this that is concerned with passions and actions, and in these there is excess, defect, and the intermediate. For instance, both fear and confidence and appetite and anger and pity and in general pleasure and pain may be felt both too much and too little, and in both cases not well. But to feel them at the right times with reference to the right objects, towards the right people with the right motive and in the right way, is what is both intermediate and best. And this is characteristic of virtue. Similarly, with regard to actions also there is excess, defect, and the intermediate. Now virtue is concerned with passions and actions, in which excess is a form of failure, and so is defect. While the intermediate is praised and is a form of success, and being praised and being successful are both characteristics of virtue. Therefore, virtue is a kind of mean, since, as we have seen, it aims at what is intermediate. Again, it is possible to fail in many ways, for evil belongs to the class of the unlimited, as the Pythagoreans conjectured, and good to that of the limited. While to succeed is possible only in one way, for which reason also one is easy and the other difficult, to miss the mark, easy, to hit it, difficult. For these reasons also, then, excess and defect are characteristic of vice, and the mean of virtue. For men are good in but one way, but bad in many. Virtue, then, is a state of character concerned with choice, lying in a mean, i.e. the mean relative to us, this being determined by a rational principle, and by that principle by which the man of practical wisdom would determine it. Now it is a mean between two vices, that which depends on excess, and that which depends on defect. And again, it is a mean because the vices respectively fall short of or exceed what is right in both passions and actions, while virtue both finds and chooses that which is intermediate. Hence, in respect of its substance and the definition which states its essence, virtue is a mean, with regard to what is best and right, an extreme. But not every action, nor every passion, admits of a mean. For some have names that already imply badness, e.g. spite, shamelessness, envy, and in the case of actions, adultery, theft, murder. For all of these and such like things imply by their names that they are themselves bad, and not the excesses or deficiencies of them. It is not possible, then, ever to be right with regard to them. One must always be wrong. Nor does goodness or badness with regard to such things depend on committing adultery with the right woman at the right time and in the right way, but simply to do any of them is to go wrong. It would be equally absurd, then, to expect that in unjust, cowardly, and voluptuous action there should be a mean, an excess, and a deficiency. For at that rate, there would be a mean of excess and of deficiency, an excess of excess, and a deficiency of deficiency. But as there is no excess and deficiency of temperance and courage, because what is intermediate is in a sense an extreme, so too of the actions we have mentioned there is no mean nor any excess and deficiency. But however they are done, they are wrong. For in general, there is neither a mean of excess and deficiency, nor excess and deficiency of a mean. 7. We must, however, not only make this general statement, but also apply it to the individual facts. For among statements about conduct, those which are general apply more widely, but those which are particular are more genuine, since conduct has to do with individual cases, and our statements must harmonize with the facts in these cases. We may take these cases from our table. With regard to feelings of fear and confidence, courage is the mean. Of the people who exceed, he who exceeds in fearlessness has no name. Many of the states have no name. While the man who exceeds in confidence is rash, and he who exceeds in fear and falls short in confidence is a coward. with regard to pleasures and pains, not all of them, and not so much with regard to the pains, the mean is temperance, the excess, self-indulgence. Persons deficient with regard to the pleasures are not often found, hence such persons also have received no name, but let us call them insensible. With regard to giving and taking of money, the mean is liberality, the excess and the defect, prodigality and meanness. In these actions people exceed and fall short in contrary ways. The prodigal exceeds in spending and falls short in taking, while the mean man exceeds in taking and falls short in spending. At present, we are giving a mere outline or summary, and are satisfied with this. Later, these states will be more exactly determined. With regard to money, there are also other dispositions. A mean, magnificence. For the magnificent man differs from the liberal man. The former deals with large sums, the latter with small ones. An excess, tastelessness and vulgarity, and a deficiency, niggardliness. These differ from the states opposed to liberality, and the mode of their difference will be stated later. With regard to honour and dishonour, the mean is proper pride, the excess is known as a sort of empty vanity, and the deficiency is undue humility, and as we said, liberality was related to magnificence, differing from it by dealing with small sums, so there is a state similarly related to proper pride, being concerned with small honours, while that is concerned with great. For it is possible to desire honour as one ought, and more than one ought, and less. And the man who exceeds in his desires is called ambitious, the man who falls short, unambitious, while the intermediate person has no name. The dispositions also are nameless, except that that of the ambitious man is called ambition. Hence the people who are at the extremes lay claim to the middle place, and we ourselves sometimes call the intermediate person ambitious and sometimes unambitious, and sometimes praise the ambitious man and sometimes the unambitious. The reason of our doing this will be stated in what follows, but now let us speak of the remaining states according to the method which has been indicated. With regard to anger also there is an excess, a deficiency, and a mean. Although they can scarcely be said to have names, yet since we call the intermediate person good-tempered, let us call the mean good-temper. Of the persons at the extremes, let the one who exceeds be called irascible, and his vice irascibility, and the man who falls short an inirascible sort of person, and the deficiency inirascibility. There are also three other means, which have a certain likeness to one another, but differ from one another. For they are all concerned with intercourse in words and actions, but differ in that one is concerned with truth in this sphere, the other two with pleasantness. And of this, one kind is exhibited in giving amusement, the other in all the circumstances of life. We must therefore speak of these two, that we may the better see that in all things the mean is praiseworthy, and the extremes neither praiseworthy nor right, but worthy of blame. Now most of these states also have no names, but we must try, as in the other cases, to invent names ourselves, so that we may be clear and easy to follow. With regard to truth, then, the intermediate is a truthful sort of person, and the mean may be called truthfulness, while the pretense which exaggerates is boastfulness, and the person characterized by it a boaster, and that which understates is mock modesty, and the person characterized by it mock modest. With regard to pleasantness in the giving of amusement, the intermediate person is ready-witted, and the disposition, ready wit. The excess is buffoonery, and the person characterized by it a buffoon, while the man who falls short is a sort of boor, and his state is boorishness. With regard to the remaining kind of pleasantness, that which is exhibited in life in general, the man who is pleasant in the right way is friendly, and the mean is friendliness, while the man who exceeds is an obsequious person if he has no end in view, a flatterer if he is aiming at his own advantage, and the man who falls short and is unpleasant in all circumstances is a quarrelsome and surly sort of person. There are also means in the passions, and concerned with the passions, since shame is not a virtue, and yet praise is extended to the modest man. For even in these matters, one man is said to be intermediate, and another to exceed. As, for instance, the bashful man who is ashamed of everything, while he who falls short or is not ashamed of anything at all is shameless, and the intermediate person is modest. Righteous indignation is a mean between envy and spite, and these states are concerned with the pain and pleasure that are felt at the fortunes of our neighbours. The man who is characterized by righteous indignation is pained at undeserved good fortune. The envious man, going beyond him, is pained at all good fortune, and the spiteful man falls so far short of being pained that he even rejoices. But these states there will be an opportunity of describing elsewhere. With regard to justice, since it has not one simple meaning, we shall, after describing the other states, distinguish its two kinds, and say how each of them is a mean. And similarly, we shall treat also of the rational virtues. 8. There are three kinds of disposition, then. Two of them vices, involving excess and deficiency, respectively, and one a virtue, viz., the mean. And all are, in a sense, opposed to all. For the extreme states are contrary both to the intermediate state and to each other, and the intermediate to the extremes. As the equal is greater relatively to the less, less relatively to the greater, so the middle states are excessive relatively to the deficiencies, deficient relatively to the excesses, both in passions and in actions. For the brave man appears rash relatively to the coward, and cowardly relatively to the rash man. And similarly, the temperate man appears self-indulgent relatively to the insensible man, insensible relatively to the self-indulgent, and the liberal man prodigal relatively to the mean man, mean relatively to the prodigal. Hence also the people at the extremes push the intermediate man each over to the other. And the brave man is called rash by the coward, cowardly by the rash man, and correspondingly in the other cases. These states being thus opposed to one another, the greatest contrariety is that of the extremes to each other rather than to the intermediate, for these are further from each other than from the intermediate, as the great is further from the small and the small from the great than both are from the equal. Again, to the intermediate, some extremes show a certain likeness, as that of rashness to courage, and that of prodigality to liberality. But the extremes show the greatest unlikeness to each other. Now, contraries are defined as the things that are furthest from each other, so that things that are further apart are more contrary. To the mean, in some cases the deficiency, in some the excess is more opposed, e.g., it is not rashness, which is an excess, but cowardice, which is a deficiency, that is more opposed to courage, and not insensibility, which is a deficiency, but self-indulgence, which is an excess, that is more opposed to temperance. This happens from two reasons. One being drawn from the thing itself, For because one extreme is nearer and liker to the intermediate, we oppose not this, but rather its contrary to the intermediate, e.g., since rashness is thought liker and nearer to courage, and cowardice more unlike, we oppose rather the latter to courage. For things that are further from the intermediate are thought more contrary to it. This, then, is one cause drawn from the thing itself. Another is drawn from ourselves. For the things to which we ourselves more naturally tend seem more contrary to the intermediate. For instance, we ourselves tend more naturally to pleasures, and hence are more easily carried away towards self-indulgence than towards propriety. We describe as contrary to the mean, then, rather the directions in which we more often go to great lengths, and therefore self-indulgence, which is an excess, is the more contrary to temperance. 9. That moral virtue is a mean, then, and in what sense it is so, and that it is a mean between two vices, the one involving excess, the other deficiency, and that it is such because its character is to aim at what is intermediate in passions and in actions, has been sufficiently stated. Hence also, it is no easy task to be good. For in everything, it is no easy task to find the middle, e.g. to find the middle of a circle is not for everyone, but for him who knows. So too, anyone can get angry, that is easy, or give or spend money, but to do this to the right person, to the right extent, at the right time, with the right motive and in the right way, that is not for everyone. Nor is it easy. Wherefore goodness is both rare and laudable and noble. Hence he who aims at the intermediate must first depart from what is the more contrary to it. As Calypso advises, hold the ship out beyond that surf and spray. For of the extremes, one is more erroneous, one less so. Therefore, since to hit the mean is hard in the extreme, we must, as a second best, as people say, take the least of the evils, and this will be done best in the way we describe. But we must consider the things towards which we ourselves also are easily carried away, for some of us tend to one thing, some to another, and this will be recognizable from the pleasure and the pain we feel. We must drag ourselves away to the contrary extreme, for we shall get into the intermediate state by drawing well away from error, as people do in straightening sticks that are bent. Now in everything, the pleasant, or pleasure, is most to be guarded against, for we do not judge it impartially. We ought, then, to feel towards pleasure as the elders of the people felt towards Helen, and in all circumstances repeat their saying, for if we dismiss pleasure thus, we are less likely to go astray. It is by doing this, then, to sum the matter up, that we shall best be able to hit the mean. But this is no doubt difficult, and especially in individual cases. For it is not easy to determine both how and with whom and on what provocation and how long one should be angry. For we too sometimes praise those who fall short and call them good-tempered, but sometimes we praise those who get angry and call them manly. The man, however, who deviates little from goodness is not blamed, whether he do so in the direction of the more or of the less, but only the man who deviates more widely, for he does not fail to be noticed. But up to what point and to what extent a man must deviate before he becomes blameworthy, it is not easy to determine by reasoning, any more than anything else that is perceived by the senses. Such things depend on particular facts, and the decision rests with perception. So much, then, is plain, that the intermediate state is in all things to be praised, but that we must incline sometimes towards the excess, sometimes towards the deficiency, for so shall we most easily hit the mean and what is right. Book 3. 1. Since virtue is concerned with passions and actions, and on voluntary passions and actions praise and blame are bestowed, on those that are involuntary, pardon, and sometimes also pity, to distinguish the voluntary and the involuntary is presumably necessary for those who are studying the nature of virtue, and useful also for legislators with a view to the assigning both of honours and of punishments. Those things, then, are thought involuntary, which take place under compulsion or owing to ignorance. And that is compulsory of which the moving principle is outside, being a principle in which nothing is contributed by the person who is acting or is feeling the passion, e.g., if he were to be carried somewhere by a wind, or by men who had him in their power. But with regard to the things that are done from fear of greater evils, or for some noble object, e.g., if a tyrant were to order one to do something base, having one's parents and children in his power, and if one did the action, they were to be saved, but otherwise would be put to death. It may be debated whether such actions are involuntary or voluntary. Something of the sort happens also with regard to the throwing of goods overboard in a storm. For in the abstract, no one throws goods away voluntarily, but on condition of it securing the safety of himself and his crew, any sensible man does so. Such actions, then, are mixed, but are more like voluntary actions, for they are worthy of choice at the time when they are done, and the end of an action is relative to the occasion. Both the terms, then, voluntary and involuntary, must be used with reference to the moment of action. Now the man acts voluntarily, for the principle that moves the instrumental parts of the body in such actions is in him, and the things of which the moving principle is in a man himself are in his power to do or not to do. Such actions, therefore, are voluntary. But in the abstract, perhaps involuntary. For no one would choose any such act in itself. For such actions, men are sometimes even praised, when they endure something base or painful in return for great and noble objects gained. In the opposite case, they are blamed, since to endure the greatest indignities for no noble end, or for a trifling end, is the mark of an inferior person. On some actions praise indeed is not bestowed, but pardon is, when one does what he ought not under pressure, which overstrains human nature, and which no one could withstand. But some acts, perhaps, we cannot be forced to do, but ought rather to face death after the most fearful sufferings. For the things that forced Euripides Alcmaeon to slay his mother seem absurd. It is difficult, sometimes, to determine what should be chosen at what cost, and what should be endured in return for what gain, and yet more difficult to abide by our decisions, for, as a rule, what is expected is painful, and what we are forced to do is base, whence praise and blame are bestowed on those who have been compelled or have not. What sort of acts, then, should be called compulsory? We answer that, without qualification, actions are so when the cause is in the external circumstances and the agent contributes nothing. But the things that in themselves are involuntary, but now and in return for these gains are worthy of choice, and whose moving principle is in the agent, are in themselves involuntary, but now, and in return for these gains, voluntary. They are more like voluntary acts. For actions are in the class of particulars, and the particular acts here are voluntary. What sort of things are to be chosen, and in return for what, it is not easy to state, for there are many differences in the particular cases. But if someone were to say that pleasant and noble objects have a compelling power, forcing us from without, all acts would be for him compulsory, for it is for these objects that all men do everything they do. And those who act under compulsion and unwillingly act with pain. But those who do acts for their pleasantness and nobility do them with pleasure. It is absurd to make external circumstances responsible, and not oneself, as being easily caught by such attractions, and to make oneself responsible for noble acts, but the pleasant objects responsible for base acts. The compulsory, then, seems to be that whose moving principle is outside, the person compelled contributing nothing. Everything that is done by reason of ignorance is not voluntary. It is only what produces pain and repentance that is involuntary. For the man who has done something owing to ignorance, and feels not the least vexation at his action, has not acted voluntarily, since he did not know what he was doing, nor yet involuntarily, since he is not pained. Of people, then, who act by reason of ignorance, he who repents is thought an involuntary agent, and the man who does not repent may, since he is different, be called a not voluntary agent. For since he differs from the other, it is better that he should have a name of his own. Acting by reason of ignorance seems also to be different from acting in ignorance. For the man who is drunk or in a rage is thought to act as a result not of ignorance, but of one of the causes mentioned, yet not knowingly, but in ignorance. Now every wicked man is ignorant of what he ought to do, and what he ought to abstain from. And it is by reason of error of this kind that men become unjust and in general bad. But the term involuntary tends to be used not if a man is ignorant of what is to his advantage, for it is not mistaken purpose that causes involuntary action, it leads rather to wickedness, nor ignorance of the universal, for that men are blamed, but ignorance of particulars, i.e., of the circumstances of the action and the objects with which it is concerned. For it is on these that both pity and pardon depend, since the person who is ignorant of any of these acts involuntarily. Perhaps it is just as well, therefore, to determine their nature and number. A man may be ignorant, then, of who he is, what he is doing, what or whom he is acting on, and sometimes also what, e.g., what instrument, he is doing it with, and to what end, e.g., he may think his act will conduce to someone's safety, and how he is doing it, e.g., whether gently or violently. Now, of all of these, no one could be ignorant unless he were mad. And evidently also he could not be ignorant of the agent, for how could he not know himself? But of what he is doing, a man might be ignorant. As, for instance, people say, it slipped out of their mouths as they were speaking, or they did not know it was a secret, as Aeschylus said of the mysteries. Or a man might say, he let it go off when he merely wanted to show its working, as the man did with the catapult. Again, one might think one's son was an enemy, as Merope did, or that a pointed spear had a button on it, or that a stone was pumice stone, or one might give a man a draught to save him and really kill him, or one might want to touch a man, as people do in sparring, and really wound him. The ignorance may relate, then, to any of these things, i.e. of the circumstances of the action, and the man who was ignorant of any of these is thought to have acted involuntarily, and especially if he was ignorant on the most important points, and these are thought to be the circumstances of the action and its end. Further, the doing of an act that is called involuntary in virtue of ignorance of this sort must be painful and involve repentance. Since that which is done under compulsion, or by reason of ignorance, is involuntary, the voluntary would seem to be that of which the moving principle is in the agent himself, he being aware of the particular circumstances of the action. Presumably, acts done by reason of anger or appetite are not rightly called involuntary. For in the first place, on that showing, none of the other animals will act voluntarily, nor will children. And secondly, is it meant that we do not do voluntarily any of the acts that are due to appetite or anger, or that we do the noble acts voluntarily and the base acts involuntarily? Is not this absurd, when one and the same thing is the cause? But it would surely be odd to describe as involuntary the things one ought to desire, and we ought both to be angry at certain things and to have an appetite for certain things, e.g. for health and for learning. Also, what is involuntary is thought to be painful, but what is in accordance with appetite is thought to be pleasant. Again, what is the difference in respect of involuntariness between errors committed upon calculation and those committed in anger? Both are to be avoided. But the irrational passions are thought not less human than reason is, and therefore also the actions which proceed from anger or appetite are the man's actions. It would be odd, then, to treat them as involuntary. 2. Both the voluntary and the involuntary having been delimited, we must next discuss choice, for it is thought to be most closely bound up with virtue and to discriminate characters better than actions do. Choice, then, seems to be voluntary, but not the same thing as the voluntary. The latter extends more widely. For both children and the lower animals share in voluntary action, but not in choice, and acts done on the spur of the moment we describe as voluntary, but not as chosen. Those who say it is appetite or anger or wish, or a kind of opinion, do not seem to be right. For choice is not common to irrational creatures as well, but appetite and anger are. Again, the incontinent man acts with appetite but not with choice, while the continent man, on the contrary, acts with choice but not with appetite. Again, appetite is contrary to choice, but not appetite to appetite. Again, appetite relates to the pleasant and the painful, choice neither to the painful nor to the pleasant. Still less is it anger. For acts due to anger are thought to be less than any others objects of choice. But neither is it wish, though it seems near to it. For choice cannot relate to impossibles. And if anyone said he chose them, he would be thought silly. But there may be a wish even for impossibles, e.g., for immortality, and wish may relate to things that could in no way be brought about by one's own efforts, e.g. that a particular actor or athlete should win in a competition, but no one chooses such things, but only the things that he thinks could be brought about by his own efforts. Again, wish relates rather to the end, choice, to the means. For instance, we wish to be healthy, but we choose the acts which will make us healthy, And we wish to be happy and say we do, but we cannot well say we choose to be so, for, in general, choice seems to relate to the things that are in our own power. For this reason, too, it cannot be opinion. For opinion is thought to relate to all kinds of things,